Welcome back, fellow paranormal aficionados. This is Haunted 518. So today I'm going to be starting off by cracking open a drink that was gifted to me by a past guest, Kevin Ryan. He brought me a Simpler Wines brand apple Italian wine cocktail, and it says frizzante, which means fizzy. Not frizzy. You are cordially invited to raise a can and bend an elbow in honor of simpler things, simpler pleasure, and simpler wines. This perfectly portable potable is impeccably portioned and ready to go for picnics, barbecues, or as an effortlessly effervescent anytime treat. It's crisp, bright, pure, bubbly fun, just waiting to be popped open. So yeah, it's exactly what it says it is. It's delicious. Almost like champagne-y. So, today, I know I've done an episode in the past, way back, one of my first episodes, actually, that was dedicated to Saratoga, but then I found some information about the Wilton area and Greenfield Center and Greenfield Porter's Corners area that I thought it's definitely worth doing a full episode about. Some of these may be overlapping, but I think the majority of them have not been told before. So, the first thing is, let's start in Wilton, then we'll move over to Greenfield Center and the Porter's Corner area, also Rock City Falls, just a few stories from there. But I wanted to start off with a little bit of history of the town of Wilton. So, located on the main warpath of the Iroquois, Wilton was known in its earliest days as Palmer Town, taken from the Palmertown range of hills in the northwest part of town. I never knew that. A small community grew at Wiltonville at the foot of Mount McGregor. The major occupation was farming, sawmills, and small businesses when General Ulysses Grant came to a small cottage on Mount McGregor to write his memoirs in 1885. After World War I, a veterans rest camp was established there, and later the institution became a minimum security prison. Much of the recent economic development surrounding Saratoga Springs has taken place in the town of Wilton. So I'm really glad that the history mentions this, because the first place that we're going to stop at is the Ulysses S. Grant Cottage National Historic Landmark, and I actually have never been there. It is on my to-do list. Definitely didn't know it was on a mountain, so that's interesting. Had no idea about the prison. Super interesting. But yeah, a few other things. So there's a review that was given on TripAdvisor, and the person said, "There be ghosts there." To get to the cottage, which is located on the grounds of the prison in Wilton, we had to enter the prison like an ordinary visitor. Very unsettling, but only because I've never visited a prison before. We drove around to the backside of the prison grounds to the cottage where Ulysses S. Grant visited before he died. The home is much larger than we expected, but visitors are only allowed on the ground floor. We were told the caretaker lives upstairs. The most unsettling part of the tour was the parlor, which was left exactly like it was when Grant died in the room. The parlor is set up with the hospital bed where Grant died, and the other end of the room is filled with specially preserved wreaths and flower sprays. It's very easy to get spooked in a place like this, but the day we visited was rainy, and the hill where the house sits was completely soaked by a thick fog. The spooky part, leaving the home's exit onto the large wraparound porch along the front of the house, we encountered two men in rocking chairs. They definitely weren't there when we got there, and the scary part is one of them was a dead ringer for Robert E. Lee, gray whiskers and all. An enjoyable stop for a couple of president's groupies. So, I didn't know it was as large as it was either. I was literally picturing maybe like a 10 by 20 foot small stone cottage. Had no idea it was actually more like a house. And I didn't realize he had died there either. I thought it was like a summer home. So, definitely going to put that on my little to-do list. And but to get out there and to see if I can talk to anybody about any spooky happenings that may or may not have happened there. So now we're going to really delve into the town of Wilton. I have a bunch of stories taken straight from David J. Pitkin's book. So the first one is the Stiles or Stills Tavern. On February 19th, 1693, a band of colonial militia under the command of Lieutenant John Schuyler met a war party of French and Indians near the spot where Parkhurst Road meets Route 9 today. For 3 days in a snowstorm, the enemies inflicted heavy casualties on one another before the French force withdrew. Today, this site is marked by an historic marker that details the event as the Battle of Wilton, unknown to most locals because of the prominence of the Battle of Saratoga 80 years later. In 1798, Benjamin Phillips built a house and barn on the site. The house was enlarged in 1804, and Reuben Stiles opened a tavern there in the 1820s. The tavern became a stagecoach stop on the North-South Highway. As with most such establishments, it was a center of local activity, a place to receive and spread news, as well as a place to hold social functions. The Stiles family prospered there until a Mr. Clark converted the building into a home. In years later, attorney Theodore Gray and his family renovated the house and found it was a comfortable dwelling. They didn't realize an unseen someone else lived there with them. A daughter in the family returned home from school one day and went into the old innkeeper's room. She heard a button drop on the old wood floor, and then another, and then another. Where had they come from? Since her mother had a collection of buttons, she picked them up to save. Previous owners had partitioned the old upstairs ballroom into two bedrooms. Coincidentally, the daughter and her sister sometimes heard faint music and the tapping of dancing feet on the floor after they were all in bed at night. Michael, a friend of the family, used to house sit for the Grays when they were on vacation. He too had some eerie experiences. Lights that he turned off would later be found turned on, and vice versa. When he went upstairs to bed at night, he sometimes found that an unseen hand had turned down his sheets for him. He discovered to his dismay that the invisible chambermaid could also be petulant. On one occasion, he found his pillow removed from the bed, its pillowcase removed and tossed aside by some ghostly servant. Taken aback by these findings, Mike shouted, "I'm enjoying what you're doing. Please don't stop on my account." His levity seemed to end that phenomenon. When a daughter became engaged, the family hosted their future son-in-law at Christmas. On Christmas Eve, they gathered around the Christmas tree for an exchange of presents. The parents had bought their guest an expensive cigarette lighter, wrapped it carefully, and placed it under the tree. As presents were exchanged, the package was found to have vanished. Hoping to avoid an unhappy suitor, the family searched high and low, inspecting the tree itself. It was just not there. While they stood around the tree on Christmas Day, a sudden noise and movement caught their attention. They observed a small present slowly slipping from a branch to branch and falling onto the floor. It was the lighter. At that point, it was truly a present to them all. The ghost had chosen to play Santa Claus. To let house dwellers know it is there, the present seems to enjoy taking things away and then returning them. The Gray family eventually sold the house, and I queried the new owners. Interestingly enough, they have had no unusual experiences in the beautiful old house. Maybe the ghost is tired of its servant role. Next is Stiles Corners. It is possible that spirits from the Battle of Wilton still haunt Parkhurst on King's Road. A woman from the Greenfield often travels through the intersection and has had several occurrences at several times observed an old man who doesn't look quite real, quote unquote, walking or standing near the historic marker. He seems to be looking for something. On another occasion, she saw, quote unquote, a man with no legs sitting there. These images haven't been observed by the longtime residents of the corners, however. The next is Sandy's House. This is the name given by the town historian Lorraine Westcott when she wrote about the house in her newspaper's column in The Saratogian. The house is about a mile north of Stiles Corners and as the crow flies. Sandy, a former owner of the house, experienced extremely cold drafts. Her dogs were terrified, and Sandy contacted a psychic to visit her house in an attempt to explain these events. The woman received an image of an older woman who had lived unhappily there. Sandy had once found some jewelry and personal effects in the attic, belonging to a woman named Agatha. So that became her name for the ghost. Eventually, she sold the house, and as the newcomers didn't ask questions, she kept Agatha a secret. An enthusiastic young couple bought the house, and the husband, a contractor, visited the house to install wall-to-wall carpet before the family moved in. As he was putting the trim in place, he heard a male voice. "What the hell are you doing?" it inquired. The young man thought his father had come by to surprise him and help him, but when he looked outside, his father's truck was not around. Nobody else was around, so he went back to work. Shortly after, the same voice repeated its question. Now the husband was sure that someone was fooling around, as he said. "I checked the whole house again, and nobody was there." He began installing a wood trim around the doorway and once more heard the query. "I said to myself, that's enough of that, and I went home," he explained. A few days later, he returned to work inside the house and was pleasantly surprised by Sandy, who showed up with a bottle of champagne and some quote-unquote history of the place. The man heard the Agatha stories and learned that the old lady had died of cancer. She left belongings in the attic of the house. Sandy had also experienced a very large boom one day, but found that none of her neighbors had heard it. She considered it to be Agatha's work, but had no idea how an old lady's ghost could replicate a sonic boom. Armed with these stories, the husband began to see what he was dealing with, though he didn't necessarily believe in ghosts. When his family moved in, he noticed that the family dog used to growl and stare at a certain corner of the living room. That corner had once been a rear corner of the garage, which he had incorporated into the wall of the house. Not far from that spot was a kitchen cabinet in which he and his wife, avid Adirondack Red Wings hockey fans, kept their season tickets. On one game night, they rushed home from work and the husband showered while his wife readied herself, then jumped into the truck ready for the good game. Then she remembered the tickets. She rushed into the house and reached into the cabinet to get that night's tickets. They weren't there. No tickets were there. The entire envelope was missing. 3 years later, all those tickets are still missing. One night in question, they were late getting to the game, having to spend time buying new tickets. On the night in question. When they reached their seats in the first period of the game, the Red Wings were behind. Now they really felt like yelling. Curiously, the next day they discovered that their tardiness had caused them to miss a very serious accident on the Glens Falls Road. Was the ghost trying to help them instead of annoy them? At another time, a stack of dinner plates moved horizontally and then fell about 2 feet onto the shelf and floor. Some broke. While Agatha got the blame, the family wonders who is the real culprit. When I visited the family, it suddenly dawned on me on how close we were to Stiles Corners. Over the course of the 3-day battle, the fighting must have raged around Sandy's house during the Battle of Wilton. One might realistically expect bodies to have been buried near the site of the conflict. I shared my thoughts with the couple. Is it possible that a soldier or Indian of a long ago battle lay buried beneath that corner? I wondered aloud. I should be able to tell you by the time your book comes out, he said. I'm going to excavate for a septic tank right out there in the spring, so we'll know for sure then. Oh, that's wild. The next one is Apple Tree Farm. The McMasters had enjoyed the old house for several years. 1993 was the year they sold it and moved on. They were happy to know that the buyers, Wayne and Kathy Butler, and their two children would love it as much as they did and make a happy home there. Oh yes, did we mention the ghost? The seller asked. Everyone laughed and the Butlers prepared to move in. Called Apple Tree Farm, the historic building had been the home of Colonel Windsor Brown French, commander of the famous 77th New York Infantry Regiment, nicknamed the Bemis Heights Regiment during the Civil War. The heavily decorated regiment drew its members from Essex, Fulton, and Saratoga counties. A large statue in Saratoga Springs Congress Park memorializes the unit. After the conflict, French retired to its frame farmhouse on Parkhurst Road in Wilton, where he lived the life of a gentleman farmer. Soon after, the Butlers set up housekeeping at the old farm. Strange events began to happen. Kathy, alone in the house one day, just emerged from the shower when she began to hear a noise. It took a minute for her to realize she was listening to the sound of all of the bedroom doors in her house opening and closing simultaneously. Oh, God. I couldn't. Her dog, usually ferocious in times of danger, slept contentedly in the downstairs. Before long, her 12-year-old daughter, Megan, began to experience the ghost. The girl's bedroom was likely the master bedroom for the prior residents of the house. The girl awoke at 4 a.m. to discover that all her bedroom lights were turned on and all the bedclothes were missing from her bed. The pillows and blankets were folded and placed in a neat row on the floor, almost like a regiment of soldiers drawn up for inspection. Her bed sheets lay folded perfectly at the foot of the bed, as if an inspecting officer were about to enter. She let out a howl and screamed until her mother came. The mother told Lorraine that the daughter was not capable of such neatness, especially at 4 a.m. When Megan's 7-year-old brother, Casey, played in her bedroom, he heard the doorknobs rattle, as if someone wanted to enter the room. But nobody was ever outside. Everyone in the family had an opportunity to participate in the experiences. Wayne, walking through the upstairs one day, saw a woman and thought her to be his wife. When he reached the downstairs, he found Kathy there. Who was upstairs? Since those events in the autumn of 1993, there have been fewer phenomena. It seems that Colonel French wanted to orient the new troops in his barracks. Now that he knows them to be trainable troops, he has eased up on them. No more early morning barracks inspections. Now may be the time for the rest and relaxation at Apple Tree Farm. Next is Christine's house. Many years ago, I had a 9th grade student who had difficulty getting her homework in on time. Every student knew Mr. Pitkin had a love of the unusual, and I knew they knew. So I gave a little credence when Christine offered me an excuse about a ghost keeping her up at night. As years went by, Christine left the Saratoga Springs area and our memories of one another dimmed. When I began research on this book, I began to follow up on one of Lorraine Westcott's other published stories about an unidentified house on Route 50 north of Saratoga Springs. My fellow teacher Chuck lived up that way, and I asked him if he knew of a house with a strange reputation in the area. "Sure," he said, "Christine's house. Don't you remember Christine telling me that she didn't have her science done because of the ghosts?" Wow, I thought, a student excuse that actually held up. Contrite because of my disbelief, I began a dedicated search for the girl who is now a housewife and mother in Arizona. I found her mother and stepfather living near Albany. Barbara said that the house always had icy cold spots in it, especially in the master bedroom. Her husband David interjected that it was just a bad luck house for us. Once I stood in the stairwell and I heard a male voice call my name. I knew I was alone in the building, at least I thought I was. David also awoke one morning with a non-rabid bat biting his hand. What? Though he didn't know its status for a few days after he went to the doctor. Oh, that's terrifying. On top of that, he said, a big tree fell on our house, and then I fell through the roof while trying to repair it once. I began to see an old man with a bald head in the upstairs, said Barbara. A neighbor said she had heard a rumor that a man had hanged himself up there once. To find more information, Barbara invited a psychic to investigate the house, but the woman would not go into a certain upstairs bedroom. I see a hanged man being cut down up there and taken to that bedroom, was her offering. Yes, that's the room we always call the Red Room, said Christine. When I spoke with her after about almost 20 years, my aunt had a miscarriage in that room, she volunteered. I was always afraid of that room from the time we came here. I was 10 at the time, she added. David said it was a regular circus. The washer and dryer sometimes turned themselves on and off. Things were always disappearing, but then always reappeared on the back of the toilet. Right, and that old bald man walking around upstairs, always humming to himself. The sound got louder and louder. My brother used to call him Popeye because he was bald. When my dad was renovating some of the upstairs, he found a bone-handled knife stuck into the wall stud. He wondered if that was the knife they used to cut down the hanged man, said Barbara. Christine remembered that some unseen person would sit on her bed, wrinkling the coverlid. I was scared, but one night saw the Virgin Mary, and after that I knew everything was going to be okay, she added. Sometimes we saw footprints on the bathroom floor when nobody had been in there. I used to call it the house from hell because you never knew what to expect next. One night I thought I was dreaming. I saw a woman in my room and started shouting her name, Gilda, or something like that, Barbara said. She believed the man who had hanged himself was out of German origin. She thinks the woman and old man are still there, Christine. I believe you now. It's all forgiven. After several conversations with the family, I looked through the property transfers for that house. Between 1940 and 43, the house was transferred between two men with Germanic names. There was no evidence of a woman listed on the deeds. Barbara may be right about the former residents. Several years ago, an energetic young couple purchased the house. They couldn't imagine whose house whose house I described to them. The wife told me that they were renovating the house more fully and were very happy with it. They experienced no ghosts there, and I'm glad. The next is the Carr Homestead, C-A-R-R. The old frame farmhouse on Northern Pines Road was built soon after the Revolutionary War, perhaps around 1789. The Carr family owned it and the house next to it for many years. Eventually, it was sold to an old Wilton family, and according to legend, the father in that family hanged himself in the house. Then a plumber and his wife purchased the house in around the time of World War II. It was their hope to operate a tourist home, the predecessor of a modern bed and breakfast there. In the late 1980s, the Campola family purchased the house and decided to do some renovation in the upstairs. I had known Karen's family for some years, and she knew of my interest in what I would call the world of weird. One day she called and told me a strange story about the contractor that she and her husband had hired to do the renovations. He had come downstairs one day and said to her, "Mrs. C, I really like the plans you have for upstairs and I enjoy doing the job, but would you please ask the old lady to back off?" Karen asked what old woman that might be. She and her husband lived there alone. "The old lady in the flower print dress," he responded. "She is always looking over my shoulder and I'm afraid she'll get hurt," he continued. Karen thought I might pick up some information. Soon, accompanied by Bill, a former student whom I know to be sensitive, and I visited the house. We liked the renovations. The old hardwood floors sparkled. The upstairs bedroom where the old lady had been seen was bright with sun shining in the uncurtained window and on the freshly painted gypsum board walls. Not considering myself a great psychic, I'm still open to sensory inputs. That happened to be one of the on days. Something in me did not want to go into that bedroom. Bill thought that was hilarious. The room was empty. My perception of the room changed. All at once it wasn't bright. Thick curtains covered both windows. In the far corner I saw what I think is a spool crib with a small child curled up beneath a blanket. At the foot of the crib, a woman sat in a chair reading from a book. My mind filled with the words, "Margaret Prays," and then it was a nice bright room again. I asked Karen whether she knew if the Carrs or other previous owners had a Margaret in the family. "I don't know, but all the Carrs are buried down in the brick church cemetery just down the road. Let's go see," she suggested. About 100 yards south of the house on Northern Pines Road is the cemetery. There were headstones for two women of the name we were seeking. Does that mean I saw a ghost? I'm more inclined to think that I picked up on some of the past. It wasn't even what Karen hoped to know about. The old lady in the flower print dress was staying put that day. In a recent discussion, Karen said she has had no ghostly activity since the contractor left. She now believes and she knows the old lady's identity, but I chose not to give the lady's name. From this and other experiences, I conclude that if a house has a ghost, the surest way to bring them out is to start some construction. I saved this story for last because it embodies so many elements of ghost stories, and it is truly filled with tragedy. And that's actually written by David Pitkin, so that is not our last story for this episode. The next place in Wilton is the Wilton Academy. In 1859, as Wiltonville expanded, Stephen Freidenberg from the town of Moreau came to the hamlet and built an academy on what is now Parkhurst Road. The school made Wilton the envy of some other rural villages. Miss Boyce, the chief instructor, promised to ensure academic excellence in the youngsters. After 2 years, she suddenly died, and the academy foundered. Freidenberg moved to Vermont and died soon after, his hopes and dreams dashed by misfortune. Private families purchased the old school building and it remained a private house until its end. The families who lived there over the next century didn't stay long. As the building aged, it was vacant for long periods, sometimes several years at a time. A local man remembers driving past the building in 1960 and often seeing a dim light in the cupola. He knew there were no residents there and that the electric power was turned off. By morning, the light had vanished. It is known that local children enjoyed breaking into the old building occasionally. It was a great place in which to scare one's friends. In 1967, the Harry Rusk family from a southern state bought the place and settled in with their 3 children. In time, the Rusks would agree to shelter several foster children besides their own. It was a large house for a large family. They began to restore parts of the old building and hoped to return it to its former early American beauty. A Unbeknown to the Rusks, other beings were already in the house. There seems to have been a continual coming and going of unseen feet on the stairways. The French doors at the foot of the staircase and on the first floor would not stay closed. Just to prove they could stay closed, Harry nailed them shut one night. In the morning, they were found open, with the fastening nail in the middle of the floor. One day, Donna, Mrs. Rusk, working alone in the house's kitchen, began to whistle a tune, but became distracted and left off whistling in mid-tune. An invisible musician in the next room finished it for her. The children were in school and Harry was away. Don, a friend of the family, was fascinated with a certain light phenomenon that could be experienced in a bedroom in the second floor. Almost any evening, if they wanted, family members could enter the bedroom, turn out the light, and sit on the bed. Within 10 to 15 minutes, they would see a faint light about 6 to 9 inches appear on the inside of the bedroom door, as if it had just come through the door. Then the light would traverse the room, seemingly looking for something. It always exited through another closed door. This event became a mysterious entertainment for the family members and visitors alike. Once they left the bedroom door open about 1.5 inches, and in the lighted hallway outside, Don caught sight of a tall, bald-headed man walking past the door. He told no one else what he had seen, figuring it had been his imagination. Several days later, one of his friends that had been in the room phoned him and asked, "Who do you think that was outside the door that night?" The friend's description was the same as Don's. Christmas time in 1967 was quite eventful. Harry called downstairs to Donna, telling her he had just witnessed two male ghosts arguing beside their bed. Then the two figures just vanished. Don was downstairs in the living room, serenading the children on his guitar. A large, slender mirror graced the room, with couches on each side. As Don played, the mirror began to sway from side to side, pendulum-like. As he continued, the mirror swept across the wall in an ever-increasing arc. Don apprehensively stopped the music. The mirror stopped, and everyone heard footsteps running to the stairs and then up them. As they listened to the steps reach the stair top, they heard them then cross to the foot of the stairway to the third floor. A friend asleep on the third floor had to rise early the next day. Hearing the pounding footsteps, he awoke and called out, "Is that you, Harry?" But no one emerged at the top of the stairs. The last week in the Academy's life was a cold one. A snowstorm blanketed Wilton. A fire started in the old tinder-dry structure in the early morning hours, possibly ignited by a kerosene heater. Flames swept through the building. A patrolling sheriff's deputy found the building almost totally involved and called area fire and rescue squads. Three of the nine children living there managed to escape. Unfortunately, Harry and Donna Rusk, two of their three children, and four foster children died in the fire. The gruesome event spelled the end of a loving family and home, and a historic structure, and the ghosts of Wilton Academy. Well, that's really sad. I didn't realize it was going to end that way, so that's really unfortunate. So next, we're going to head over to the town of Greenfield Center area, before we pop up and over to Porter's Corners and Rock City Falls. But I wanted to give a little bit of history on Greenfield also before we get into it. The town came into being in March of 1793 and was, from the beginning, an ideal place to farm. The abundance of streams also provided a power source for small sawmills and other shops. At Middle Grove in the southwest part of the town, a glass factory and some paper mills provided non-agricultural employment. Later, a graphite mine was opened in the same area. Many beautiful old homes are to be found in Greenfield, a testimony to the hard-working settlers who found the American dream could become a reality there. So the first spot in Greenfield is Lake Desolation Road. It was a sparkling winter's afternoon, and Jerry Ferris and his friend Bill Quinn intended to get in as much snowmobiling as they could before nightfall. It was quite a drive up Lake Desolation Road, and they had to investigate several turnoffs before they found a good one on the right side of the road. While Bill backed the vehicle into that spot, Jerry walked over to the old farmhouse to be sure the owner had no objection to their rig being parked there for some hours. He knew someone was home because the kitchen light shone brightly through the window, even though it was afternoon. Through the door, Jerry saw an old man standing near the kitchen table, while the man's dog wandered nearby. When Jerry knocked on the door, the old man looked up but made no movement to open the door. Instead, he turned and took a seat at the table. Ferris was frustrated that even the dog seemed to ignore him. After one more knock and a negative response, Jerry chose to assume that they had permission for the parking spot. Mounting their mechanical chargers, the two men swept off to enjoy the winter wonderland. Hours later, in pitch black of a moonless night, the two men returned to their rig and fastened the two snowmobiles securely on the trailer. Casting a glance at the old farmhouse, Ferris noted that the house was now dark, but that wasn't unusual for rural farmhouses once the sun was down. Several years later, he and his wife built a beautiful home beside Lake Desolation, and he came to view the area more as a resident than as a visiting sportsman. During a summer vacation there in 1988, he met Phyllis and her son while dining at Tinney's, a favorite lakeside restaurant. Jerry made an offhand remark about a rude old man who lived up the road who hadn't troubled himself to answer the door 4 years earlier. It didn't take Phyllis long to recognize that the house in the question was hers. She told Jerry that no old man lived there then and no such person had lived there in 84. When he had that experience. In fact, she had lived in the house for the past 20 years. As the conversation progressed, Phil and Phyllis understood that the Ferrises weren't about to ridicule the idea of ghosts. She revealed more. She and her son had often heard dogs' toenails striking the kitchen floor, though no animal was in the house. Sometimes the dog was linked with the old man at that place, and they believed that the pair to be former residents of the house. They told of hiring a contractor to completely re-roof the house during the previous year. At the end of his day's labors, he asked Phyllis who was the old man who had been sitting on a stump all day with a dog sitting patiently alongside him. The roofer described the same old man that Jerry had seen. Apparently, man's best friend continues his relationship for a longer period than we think. The next location is the Wayside Inn. Before 1800, travelers could find rest and a good meal at the Wayside Inn on the road from Greenfield Center to Wilton. To local farm folk, it was a logical place for a social get-together and political meeting. In 1801, it became the first meeting place of St. John's Lodge, a Masonic fraternity that still serves the surrounding communities. When one tours the historic house, a secret step on the stairs is shown, a device that prevented uninitiated men from entering the lodge meetings. Most folks in Greenfield felt passionately about the evil of slavery, and many local people cooperated in the secret operation of the Underground Railroad, which was sometimes routed through Saratoga County. It is possible that Wayside Inn was a station along the way. Dale and Karen Shook, the present owners of the building, note that there is an extensive tunnel in the basement which leads underneath the road to a neighboring house. For many years after stagecoaches were replaced by buses and automobiles, the property was owned by Harold Hall, who ran a large dairy farm there until 1970. Over the 10 years of the next few owners, the size of the property shrunk to its present 10 acres. Today, the old inn is a bed and breakfast with modern conference center beside it. One of the guests at the inn asked Karen if she might identify the quaintly dressed old lady seated in the living room. Mrs. Shook looked and no one was there, and she knew anyway that the inn had no elderly guest, certainly none wearing bonnets. Perhaps even ghosts take some time off to rest up between hauntings. The next is the house at Locust Grove Corners. A 93-acre farm once occupied one corner of this intersection, and the old house dates back perhaps to the first half of the 1800s. An old iron gate at the rear of the property reminds inhabitants of the grandeur of times past. Before the present owner, a Mr. Robinson owned the property. It had been sold to him on the condition that he care for an old widow who resided there. His idea of caring seems to have involved converting a large chicken coop into a small cottage and having her live there until her life ended. The present owner knew something was odd when the former owners asked permission to say goodbye to the ghost following the real estate closing. Now that it is her house, she also hears Henry, as she affectionately calls him, walking up the front stairs. She wonders if some great tragedy took place there in the past, because she is sometimes awakened at night by a frantic pounding on her front door. She can easily see the door from her window upstairs, and no one is ever there. She feels that the seasons are somehow tied to the increase or decrease in ghostly activity. At certain times of the year, things are sure to go haywire, she noted. Once she came downstairs and spied one of two pictures supposed to hang beside one another sitting across the room. It had hung as the other did on nail hangers. What unseen force had removed it? As her friends knew, she loves peacocks, and peacock pictures or designs are found everywhere in the house. One of her favorites is a two-foot tall wire construction fastened securely, or so she thought, to the wall of the living room. Recently, she found it missing, but later located it on the floor, leaning against the wall behind her piano. A workman examining the foundation in her cellar noted that it is really a very old house. There are three different types of brick or stone construction visible there. Many past residents have left their imprint on the house. In 1989, her son went into the garage to have a smoke, but returned soon after, white as a sheet. I was leaning against the garage wall and saw a shovel on the opposite wall detach itself and come through the air right at me. Around Christmas, that time of the year, she went upstairs for about 4 p.m. to put away some clothing in a bedroom. As she entered the room, she paused and instantly felt the air movement of someone sweeping past her. Then she heard what sounded like a self-conscious giggle. Whoever it was had just gone into an adjoining bedroom. Now when she enters the room, she always turns on a light first. Nevertheless, old-time residents of the house will probably continue living in their reality, and perhaps that activity involves having a bit of fun with the good-natured woman who owns it. The next is Lombardi Farm. Another of Greenfield's attractive bed and breakfast establishments sits quietly to the east of Locust Grove Road. Most vacationers who sojourn there are liable to enjoy the New York Yankees memorabilia that Dr. Vincent Lombardi had installed on the walls, or they will remember Kathy Lombardi's delicious meals. Few will appreciate that they have come to a historic house, once the residence of Benjamin Dyer, a stem-winding anti-slavery preacher from Vermont. Dyer came to Saratoga County in the early 1860s and, continuing his abolitionist involvement, opened his gentleman's farmer's home to the furtive movement of escaped slaves by night. The Underground Railroad is supposed to have used this house briefly before the Civil War ended. After the war, Dyer immersed himself in the Republican Party politics and then the Christian life, opening a guest house, the Vermont House, in nearby Saratoga Springs. It was a haven for temperance Christians in the face of what some consider the immorality of that resort city. After Dyer died, his farm was poorly maintained and eventually was abandoned by the 1940s. When the Lombardis came to Greenfield, the house was in ruins. Lovingly, they restored the building to a Victorian appearance while raising their family there. Kathy was occasionally irked by a problem on the third step of the stairway to the second floor. It was as if an invisible hand would push her or seeking to trip her up, a small irritation. Soon, Kathy met new friends who were interested in metaphysics. For 6 years, a small circle of friends met regularly at her house trying to enhance their psychic ability. Physically, several members of the group determined that the cold spots in the house were the residue of the days when freed slaves had hid in the house. One psychic who visited them opined that a freed slave woman had died in the house, perhaps by violence, and so had her baby son, whose name they determined to be Jesse. The psychic also felt that the mother and child had become long separated after death and were still seeking each other, one another, along Locust Grove Road. Assuming this story to be true, the group members spoke to Jesse as if he were still alive in the house. They urged him to accept his death and move into the light. After that, there was never again a problem on the third stair step. Cold spots no longer exist at Lombardi Farm. Benjamin Dyer would be happy at the success of his old house has become, offering hospitality to those who want a warm home when away from home. The next one is called the Angel of Allen Road. Formerly known as Thunder Run Farm, the house is not readily distinguishable from other farmhouses that line Greenfield's back roads. For one young man, however, the house held several unforgettable experiences. Probably it was built by in the early 1930s, and according to legend, it was a home to a man with a sickly daughter. It is said that the father fell downstairs one day and died. His body was discovered 3 days later, and the girl was moved to another dwelling. When the young man came to live there at age 14, he observed a ghostly, stocky older man who shuffled from room to room upstairs, wearing a brown suit and long coat. His appearances were more frequent, about once a week in the winter. He just went about his invisible business and never bothered the other inhabitants. It is hard to know how to categorize another experience that happened just once. The lad was seated next to a wooden interior door of the house. His attention was drawn to the wood grain on the door panel. The pattern in the wood seemed to move slightly. Then all at once it took on a humanoid shape and thrust a figure out into the room. What? It looked to him like a wooden angel, standing with arms outstretched and eyes closed, still connected by a thread of some sort to the door. In the next instant, it withdrew into the door panel, and the surface of the door seemed normal once again. Needless to say, this experience caused him to be curious about ghosts in the afterlife. He also began to ask questions about the history of the house before his family came there, and learned that the story about the old man and the girl. He has moved on now, and the house sits vacant, but he still wonders that if that was an experience that only he could have, or future residents will see the same ghosts. So, the next one is called The Haunted Automobile. This story was first told by Greenfield Center psychotherapist Eileen Leary at a meeting of the Compassionate Friends. Eileen is widely known for her expertise in grief counseling at New Insights on Grange Road. Christopher, a bright teenager from the Capital District, had died. Try as he might, Chris's father could not get past his sorrow without professional help. In a therapy session, he voiced one troubling issue. "When I'm riding alone in the car, I often have a strange experience," he said. "When Chris was younger, he often passed gas in the car, and it used to drive me nuts. But now that he's gone, I still get that smell at times," said the father. "Well, what did you do when Chris was alive and did that?" Eileen inquired. The father said, "I'd yell out, 'Chris, stop that.'" "So go back and drive the car," said Eileen, "and if that smell comes again, just say what you always did. He may just be communicating with you to let you know he's still there and is okay." Ending the therapy session, the father sped away. In less than a half hour, he was back. "What happened?" asked Eileen. "Well, hardly. I had gotten out onto the road, then I smelled that smell again. So I said, 'Christopher, how many times have I told you not to fart in the car?' And it stopped." "Maybe," said the father. "That was his way of letting me know he was all right. And I let him know I got the message." Eileen notes that death is not the end. Many times her clients catch a special sound or odor or some other memento of a deceased loved one. It may be just our mind remembering, but it also can be the spirit of our loved one proving to us that love and affection continue on long past the grave. The next one is called Zorro. Shortly after the new home was finished in 1969, the family moved in. Within the first month, the housewife began to see a shadowy man dressed in black walking throughout the house. Sometimes she would see him in the doorway of the master bedroom, and she began to call him Zorro, after the Mexican hero of film and television. She didn't dare talk to him, however. Between her house and Route 9 runs a stone wall, bordering Splinterville Hill, a road notorious for 70 years as the scene of automobile accidents. Legend has it that after World War II, a local young man named Teddy failed to round the deceptive turn, skidded his car into that stone wall, and died there. When she was a young wife living in California before coming to Greenfield, she of course had never heard that story. In California, however, she had had an encounter with the departed spirit of her aunt, who seemed to watch over her and teach her things she didn't consciously know. So she was ready for Zorro or Teddy, but nobody else in the family ever saw him. Zorro appears only at intervals, sometimes just sitting and sometimes only standing with hat on head, seeming to observe their family life. Nobody in their family smokes, but the housewife occasionally smells a menthol cigarette odor, but she has never talked with the specter, though she is not frightened of him. Because he seems harmless, she is in no hurry to see Zorro leave her house. And then the next one is the ghost of Balow Road, B-A-L-L-O-W. Or OU, sorry. A friend of mine, a professional woman, puts in long hours at work and was returning one night to her home northwest of Porter's Corners. Probably I was going a bit fast, but Ormsby Road has little traffic that time of night, and I wanted to get home and let down, she said. All at once, there was a man standing at the road right in front of me. Though I was practically standing on the brake pedal, I knew I wasn't going to stop in time. I braced for an impact, and that never came. I drove right through him, she related. When the car stopped, she jumped out and checked the road, but something told her there would be no one lying there, and she was right. For a long while, she sat in the middle of Ormsby Road until nerves settled a bit. All she remembered from that flash of that encounter is that he was dressed in a green shirt and slacks. That experience was enough to last a lifetime, but she wasn't finished with him yet. 5 years later, while passing a cemetery at almost the same spot on that road, she saw him again. This time he was standing beside the road and carrying a large packet or portfolio. Again, his attire was green. Was he real or imagined? She is an artist and therefore quite sensitive to colors, shapes, and music. During the summer, when standing in her front yard on Bilal Road, she hears quiet flute music coming from the forest across the road. There is no dwelling in those woods for perhaps 20 miles. True, she did buy her home from a musician, but his forte was the piano. Who or what cares enough to create the serenade? One day she heard the wicker chair in the corner of her bathroom give, as if a weighty person had just sat in it. This happens more often nowadays, though she can't guess why. In her peripheral vision, she often catches glimpses of shadows that seem to move throughout her living room, rather than just fall on the surface. How can there be a shadow in midair if there's nothing solid for it to fall on? She said. And her cats seem to notice these unseen presences, staring at objects or movements that no human sees. The woman and her husband had been restoring the old farmhouse to a beauty and comfort that the previous owners never enjoyed. One night last year, exhausted by her toils, she went to bed. About an hour later, she roused and opened her eyes. And there he was, the man in green, standing in her bedroom doorway. Then he just disappeared. One might ascribe these experiences to an overactive imagination because she was very creative, but the crowning event so far seems hard for even the skeptic to explain away. Her cellar is that of an even older house on that site. In keeping with the country theme of the house, she has numerous old-fashioned frying pans, heavy cast iron ones hanging on spikes which are driven into the cellar ceiling beams at about a 45 degree angle. Hearing a crash in the cellar one day, she rushed down to see the pans had fallen. Okay, some unusual ground tremor might have caused it, but why were the pans found up against the opposite wall of the cellar 15 feet away? And how can not just one, but a number of such implements, some weighing a pound or more, suddenly jump upward to escape the nail hanger? And how can they change direction and fly forward across 15 feet of that space? Then there is the cellar wood pile. Not far from where the pans hang is a pile of kindling, neatly stacked to a height of about 6 feet and ready for the upstairs wood stoves. This stack leans towards the cellar wall at an angle of about 10 degrees to prevent the wood from falling. A skeptic must explain how one day, without a sound, the entire pile just fell outward onto the cellar floor, disregarding Newtonian principles. One wonders what is next for that artist's house. Have the ghost or ghosts decided to help with the redecoration? Or is it possible that the ghost in green is trying to demonstrate some of the schemes that he has in his portfolio? So that was all the stories from David Pitkin's book, and now we're going to move on to a few personal stories submitted for Greenfield Center. The first one is submitted by Zach. My family and I lived in a house on Brigham Road for 3 years. It was definitely haunted. We heard footsteps. All four of us saw doors open and close by themselves. My parents and sisters saw shadows and heard talking from nowhere in the middle of the day. My sister had her covers pulled off her twice while she was in bed. That freaks me out after seeing The Conjuring. On the day we moved out, my mom and I saw one of the doors at the top of the stairs slam shut right in front of us. There were no windows open, and it was hard to close that door anyway because it would get caught on the carpet at about halfway. I didn't really believe in ghosts before we moved there, but I certainly do now after having lived there. And a few people followed up with that saying, I just moved to Brigham Road. What was the address? 4 days into the new house and the woods have something creepy going on. And someone named Audrey said, I used to live on Brigham Road. Both of my parents committed suicide. And I often wonder if my old house is haunted. And then the last one is submitted by Madeline. I was walking with my friends on 9N and I saw what they call the Ghost of Greenfield. I only knew a bit about him then. I went online and found out that he died by getting hit by a train. So they say he is trying to scare you because you and your friends are close to the train tracks. So that is it for Greenfield. And then the next place I just want to pop over to quickly is Porter's Corners, also close. The first one is submitted by Ashley. I live in High Spot Mobile Home Park in Greenfield Center, and I live in one of the oldest trailers in the park. Every day when I'm home with my daughter alone, I hear footsteps up and down my hallway. My one-year-old daughter refuses to be in her room by herself. I took it upon myself to speak with the landlord about this, and she told me in the 70s a man lived in the trailer by himself and was robbed at gunpoint. We think he might have been shot or something. We have all had our share of weird experiences in the place, and I can't afford to move, so that's a tough position to be in. And then the next one is submitted by Bailey. My sister was talking to someone in her bed at night that she called Mr. One. One day, my mom looked through an old book of family pictures, and my sister spotted my great-great-grandpa, who she had never seen before, and said, "That's Mister." That's wild. And then lastly, we're going to finish it up with two personal stories from Rock City Falls on our little road trip around the Wilton, Greenfield area. Submitted by Michael. Every night for the past week, I've been waking up at 3 a.m. on the dot. Before I would go to bed, I would shut my door, and around 3 a.m. I would awake to someone calling my name. Upon waking up, I notice that my covers are off the bed and my door is wide open, and I feel a sense as if someone is watching me. And then the next one and last one is submitted by Mr. Lax Rules. One day I was fishing in the falls and I see a very old doll floating down the creek. And as soon as it falls over the falls, an ear-splitting mysterious scream took the land. That's crazy. And then he also said, another time, sitting on the edge of the creek with friends, and one of the windows falls out of the old house in front, and my friend jumps into the water, and we case for him, wondering what's wrong. I'm not sure what that means. We case for him, wondering what's wrong, and he was just shaking and pointing at the old house, saying that a little girl jumped out the window. Could these stories be connected? So, my friends, I hope you truly enjoyed that little, awesomely historically spooky episode of the Wilton Greenfield Center, Greenfield area, with a little dip into Porter's Corners and Rock City Falls. I believe at this point, friends, that we only have about maybe two or three episodes left of towns in the haunted, in the 518 area code. But I do have, like I've been saying in past episodes, some other episodes lined up. But it is really crazy because I've been wanting to do Wilton and Greenfield area for a while. So I'm really glad that we got to dive into this. So I hope you enjoyed it. So yeah, so big cheers to David Pitkin as always. When I use his resources, I always am super grateful and appreciative. And ghostsofamerica.com is always really wonderful also and super helpful. So I hope you guys enjoyed this little road trip around that area. And as always, happy haunting.